Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. Today, I'm joined by Mark Mason to muse on a trio of recent books that deal with the nobility and monarchy. In 17 Carnations, The Windsors and the Nazis and the Cover-Up, we'll investigate the links between the British aristocracy and Hitler. We'll lead through the pages of Lady Jane Wellesley's memoir of her family in Wellington, A Journey Through My Family, and we'll discover Queen Elizabeth's sense of humour in The Wicked Wit of Queen Elizabeth II. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Mark. We're going to begin with 17 Carnations, The Windsors, The Nazis and The Cover-Up, which tells the tale of King Edward VIII and Wallace Simpson's relationship with the Nazis and the German elite. The book delves into a conspiracy where Edward, who abdicated in order to marry Simpson, would serve as a puppet king to form an alliance with Germany if the Nazis had won the war. Well, Mark, this book comes from Andrew Morton, who we know for his famous or infamous book about Diana, Princess of Wales, which ended up revealing quite a few things which turned out to be true. Now, with this book, is it the same approach? Is he looking for the dirt?
He is looking for the dirt. I don't think it's as successful as the Diana book. I mean, largely because there he was, whole chunks of that book were dictated by Diana, just literally by her to him. So he was getting it straight from the horse's mouth, and it was astonishing stuff about the most famous woman in the world coming from her. So it was going to be an international bestseller. This, he's dealing with stuff which is 70 years old now. It's the story of how Edward VIII was, you know, very close to the Nazis and reputedly was trying to, you know, engineer a peace treaty between Britain and Germany, and use his friendship with Hitler to do that. And so it's 70 years old. It's an interesting story, but Morton hasn't really got, he's never actually, there's no smoking gun. He can't prove anything absolutely, utterly sensational. But it's one of those books where you don't really mind that, because it's a look back into a different world, just an incredible world of royalty and how barking mad lots of the British royal family are, or certainly were back then, and the incredible lives they live. And they live them amongst people called things like Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe-Langenburg. And they go off and have holidays where, you know, Wallace Simpson doesn't come out of it very well. She sends back her staff at one point to recover some things she's forgotten in a house that's now been taken over by the Nazis. And she's got diplomats on the case who should actually be dealing with the war that's going on, quite an important matter at the time. And they're sent back to retrieve her swimsuit. And so they nicknamed that Operation Cleopatra's Whim. It's one of those stories that, you know, it's not a stunning piece of military history or diplomatic history, but there's some lovely little details in there.
And we should say that, you know, the story of the fact that there was a link is well known. Though, you know, there's photographic evidence to back it up, that they met Hitler, that they went to Germany. But it was a social whirl at that time in pre-war Britain, where, you know, the Germans were here with their embassy. They were entertaining. There were crossovers socially, and as you say, many of the Germans were aristocrats as well. And we should just explain that the 17 carnations of the title, that has a link to the Germans, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's Ribbentrop, the ambassador in London, the German ambassador, supposedly, and again, this is one of the things that Morton can't absolutely prove, but there was lots of gossip that Ribbentrop and Wallace Simpson were having an affair, and supposedly Ribbentrop used to send her 17 carnations every day. You know, that's where the title comes from. But you're absolutely right. Lots of this is documented. You know, it's no secret that Edward and Wallace went to Germany, went to Berlin in 1937. The crowds were chanting Heil Edward. The Duke gave the Nazi salute at one point, although he was aware that it was a slight problem and he changed the salute on a different occasion. You know, he wasn't an out-and-out, doing an out-and-out Nazi salute saying Hitler's the best thing ever. Although he did, you know, as late as 1940, he's telling friends, Hitler, quote, Hitler is a very great man. And looking back on it, lots of it is very chilling now. On that tour of Germany in 1937, they can see in the distance, they can see one of the concentration camps, and they ask about it. And the Nazis say, oh, that's where we saw the cold meat. And you don't, it's left open as to whether that was a deliberately sick joke or whether the Nazis were just trying to cover it up. Lots of it is very chilling looking back on it. But then there's also the comic stuff in there that Wallace would never allow Edward his first cocktail until 7 o'clock in the evening because she knew he had a drinking problem.
So she was wise on some occasions. But if you want to know more about that incredible period, 17 Carnations, The Windsors, The Nazis and The Cover-Up is the book for you. It's by Andrew Morton and it's out now, published by Michael O'Mara Books. Let's move on now to the first Duke of Wellington. 2015 marks 200 years since his victory at Waterloo. And to celebrate it, Lady Jane Wellesley, a descendant of Wellington, has written a memoir which reveals a family tree of rather interesting and eccentric characters called Wellington, A Journey Through My Family. Mark, perhaps you can tell us a few of the characters who do pop up in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the main one, obviously, is her great-great-great-grandfather. I've got that right, yeah. Three greats and then the grandfather, who is the first Duke of Wellington. Arthur Wellesley, as he started off in life, became the first Duke of Wellington. And he's there most of the way through. You know, it's the book centres around him. And it's really interesting, you know, comparing him with the other two, the subjects of the other two books we're talking about today. He wasn't royalty, but he was almost as good as royalty. He was a military hero, then became prime minister. He was one of the aristocracy, one of the ruling classes. Just how different things were back then. You know, the royals really have to be careful now, not so much in Edward's day, but certainly now, Queen Elizabeth II, they have to give a lot of thought to how they conduct their PR and what their people think of them. You know, you saw that when Diana died, the way the Queen had to be very careful about how she reacted. But back then, the Duke of Wellington, everyone calls it, he's well known as the Iron Duke. And you just assume that would be because he was a great war leader, like Man of Steel, Stalin. It's that sort of feel to it. But actually, he got the name because when he was prime minister, he was so opposed to what the mass of the people wanted. They wanted an extension of voting rights apart from anything else. He was so opposed to it that they used to throw stones at his windows of his London house, Apsley House, and that he had to have iron shutters put over the windows. That's where the name the Iron Duke comes from. It's a real reminder that things were very different back then.
So tell me, is the book reasonably balanced? And that sounds like a slightly tough story to tell about your great ancestor. But does she kind of say, actually, he had his flaws as well then?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, she's aware of that. There's no point just writing a book. You know, that's the attraction of the book, is that it is coming from within the family. And there's lots of stories about who was having an affair with who and all that sort of stuff based on family gossip. So you feel as though you're getting a personal rather than a strictly impartial academic history. And it's nice. But yes, she does. She's very, very even-handed. And she reveals the sadnesses of their lives, apart from the triumphs. And one of the saddest things in the book is about the first Duke himself. As a young man, he was quite talented on the violin and he used to like playing. And then Kitty, who ended up becoming his wife, the first time he tried proposing to her, he did the thing of not asking her father for her hand in marriage, but he asked her brother because her father had recently died. So he went to Kitty's brother and said, could I marry her? And he said, no, she's not going to go out with someone. She's not going to marry someone who plays the violin, because it was seen as quite a feat and not a thing that a serious man of affairs should be doing. So Wellington went away and burnt his violin and never played the violin again. And, you know, there's genuinely sad stuff like that. And then also the wonderful stuff that you always get, as we were saying with the first book, the wonderful stuff you get with the English aristocracy is just how mad they can be. The second Duke of Wellington, the first Duke's son, his country house used to have the lawn mowed in those days by a lawnmower that was pulled by horses. And he got annoyed that the horses' hooves were leaving an indentation on his lawn. So instead he swapped the horses for an elephant to pull the lawnmower. And it's not explained. I presume that Jane Wellesley means that because the elephant's got bigger feet, you know, the load's more spread out. But yeah, this elephant used to live in a hut next to the lawnmower and they fed it and that was its job. I ended up feeling quite sorry for him as well, actually, the second Duke, because...
I thought you meant the second elephant.
Well, I feel very sorry for him, yeah. I wonder if they do that with their elephants. I wonder if the son of the first elephant inherits the title. Does he become second Duke of Elephant? The second Duke was famous for saying, think what it will be when the Duke of Wellington is announced and only I come into the room. you know, he knew just how tough it is being the son of someone like that, and the expectations that people are going to have of you, and how can you possibly ever live up to them?
Well, I'm just diving in, Mark, because we've got one more book to fit in. It sounds like a bit of a bittersweet journey, but that's Wellington, A Journey Through My Family, and it's out now, and it's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. And finally, Mark, we're going to end with The Wicked Wit of Queen Elizabeth II, a short book. I'm not sure how short it is. A short book that lets us know that you can rule the country and have a sense of humour. Does this really reveal much about the Queen?
Yeah, I ended up quite liking her, having read this. She's got that sort of, you know, all the cliches, the stiff upper lip and all that sort of stuff. But she's got a very dry wit. The Privy Council, which is the meeting of all her advisors, most of whom are MPs and lords and the great and the good. Claire Short, the British Labour politician, accidentally left her mobile phone on during a Privy Council meeting, and it rang. And the Queen looked across at her and said, "Anyone important?" And then she met... You sometimes wonder... of course, she's nearly 90 now, and so she's not... For instance, the bit about where she meets Eric Clapton, I think when he was given one of his honours in 2005, she met him and she said, "Have you been playing a long time?" And it's okay, she's going to be out of touch, but you just wonder if some of these are a little bit deliberate. And my favourite one of those was to Tracy Emin, who, when they opened the Turner Gallery in Margate, down in Kent... Tracy Emin was there and the Queen came to open it. And the Queen said to her, "Oh, this is wonderful. Do you show internationally as well as in Margate?" And I think that's the... Of course the Queen's going to know who Tracy Emin is. Apart from anything else, she'll have had advisors telling her. I think she just likes winding people up. She has a bit of a laugh, I have to say.
Well, you can imagine if you're the person who kind of always has to be kind of looking serious and engaged... It must kind of get you at some moments. You surely want to have, you know, a few cracks along the way. Plus, she's in an interesting position. She knows so much about people, as you say, that she can play off her kind of her royal manners every now and then. And finally, Mark, tell us one more story.
Well, you're right about the wanting to sort of get away from all the formality. When Michael Fagin, the famous incident where a guy called Michael Fagin broke into the palace and ended up in the Queen's bedroom first thing in the morning, she stayed very calm and it was all sorted out. And then one of the policemen who came along to attend to it, when he saw that he was going to be in the presence of the Queen, he stopped to straighten his tie. And the Queen said, "Oh, come on, get a bloody move on."
And are they all just told as anecdotes in the book?
They are, and there's little facts in there about, and brilliant things about how practical she is as well, like with her dresses, to stop her dresses doing a Marilyn Monroe thing of blowing up in the wind. She has little curtain weights, the weights you put at the bottom of curtains to stop them blowing up. She has those sewn into the hem of her dresses. And they get them at Peter Jones, a little store just down the road from Buckingham Palace, for £1.50 for six. There's lovely little stuff like that. It's a wonderful book. Really liked it.
Certainly, because some style tips as well from the Queen. That's The Wicked Wit of Queen Elizabeth II. It's by Karen Dolby. It's out now and it's published by, again, Michael O'Mara Books. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Our thanks to Mark Mason, as ever. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. My producer was Holly Fisher and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again tomorrow for this week's film reviews. But for now, thank you very much for listening.